Welcome to Moss Marketing Mondays, aka the M3 Podcast.
Brought to you by Moss Marketing Group.
Bringing you everything marketing every Monday. Stay tuned for marketing tips and tricks you can use today. The M3 Podcast, marketing knowledge to help you succeed. Let's get started.
Welcome back to the M3 Podcast. I think our intro continuously gets louder and louder every single time we start that. I think that might be on Ricky.
I think he's just trying to make sure that we're awake,
yeah.
Honestly.
I mean, you're not going to... I did just wake up from a nap about 10 minutes ago, but I'm awake now.
Yeah, at least you woke up from your nap. I'm looking at Dre right now, who's asleep on the couch.
We have more awake than Dre is.
I also feel like it's getting more abrupt, too. We're just sitting here, and then Ricky just hits a button.
Just blows your drums out. But this week, we have Ben Hartwig on, and a longtime friend of Logan's. Not a longtime friend of Dahl and I, newer friend to us. But you guys went to high school together, and we are down here in Tulsa this weekend for the LIV Golf Tournament. And we thought, what better time to bring Ben on the podcast and hit a mobile podcast down here. We're sitting in the kitchen of our Airbnb.
Yeah.
So thank you for coming on. You don't have to look at the camera all the time.
I was looking at Dre asleep over there. I pretty much got on just because Dre was asleep. So thanks, Dre.
We had this all planned before, so that's why Dre's faking that he's asleep over there.
Yeah. So Ben and I go way back. I think we met when we were probably 6 years old.
Bus 11.
Good old bus number 11. Our parents grew up about a mile from each other. Also grew up about a mile and a half from Dre and Dane. Just didn't know them at the time because they were in Kearney and we were in E-Town.
By E-Town, he means Excelsior Springs, in case anybody was... I know they try to hide that, but we went to Kearney, and they went to Excelsior Springs.
Yeah, thanks for that. I'm glad you clarified that means a lot. So Ben's family, and Ben, since graduating high school, has a pretty good background in business and entrepreneurship, kind of a cool story with the family. So tell us kind of how you grew up, what your introduction to business was like, what the family did, all that type of stuff.
Yeah, so I grew up in Excelsior, as you said. Family owned a pharmacy. We had 17 retail locations between pretty much...
Just get a little closer to it.
The microphone's not working very well.
Just don't put it in your mouth.
I'm trying to put it out. we had 17 pharmacies between kind of Kearney and Macon, Missouri. So all throughout North Central Missouri. And that's kind of where I got my start in business. And then from there, went to Mizzou and then went to UMKC, graduated with Logan. I was an accounting student and then went to BKD and did the public accounting route. Now I'm at North Point. So
you guys exited the pharmacies.
Yeah. In 2018, they sold to CVS, or Red Cross did. So we moved on from that. Pharmacies are pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Well, right now, the couple of big players, Walgreens, CVS, and Walmart, pretty much own everything. And it's hard for the little guys in pharmacy right now, for sure.
Yeah.
But makes sense. I feel like there's big players in every space that are going after. And so what's the difference between like a CVS and if you're a small pharmacy on trying to run in today's world? Like, what things make it more difficult?
I mean, when CVS is willing or is able to buy the insurance companies and stuff, they can kind of rewrite the rules for themselves, and that changes things considerably.
Like in terms of like cheaper prices for medications,
yeah,
more access to medications.
100%. They can pretty much exclusively pull people from a certain plan. So in Marshall, for example, ConAgra, one of the biggest places, or one of the biggest employers in Marshall, if their insurance company says you can only go to CVS because they're owned back door by CVS, then they have to drive to Sedalia, which is 30 minutes south, to get their prescriptions at CVS, opposed to going to any place. And
pretty smart business move,
essentially. Monopolizing
it's people.
So what has the accounting world looked like getting into that side of it?
So I started in public accounting, and that's the hours are pretty brutal and the pay is not as great, but it's kind of a cut your teeth type thing. You knew you kind of had to do it coming out of school. So I did that for 2 years and decided that was not great. Knew I wanted to do something in real estate. And that's when I kind of found North Point. I still wanted to use my accounting degree, so that was important to me. And North Point was able to put me in as a development accountant, and I was kind of able to run with that. But accounting, when I was going through college and decided I didn't want to do pharmacy, I kind of tried to look at several high net worth people, and I saw accounting as a general consensus is what they had as their degree in college, at least, or started out in the public field and then branched off. So that's kind of where I...
You mean you didn't see a lot of people out there with like geology and physics degrees?
Well, I didn't talk to a lot of them because I wasn't going to go
that route. Now you became friends with Dalton and I. Yeah.
Yeah. I wrote off the calculus stuff. And
we are sitting with two scientists right now. So hey, maybe we should be interviewing them.
Hey, the only plus side that comes from that is I get a discount on my insurance. That's a plus.
Yeah, how much cheaper is your insurance than Dre's?
Oh, mine's half the price of his.
Well,
so.
Like I was telling Dre, I think it might be his driving part of his.
That could also have something to play into it. Yeah. So it's a lot more fun making fun of Dre when he's like not even awake.
Ricky's going to have some B-roll that he'll cut in right here of Dre sleeping.
I think the fact that you tried to scare Dre and Ricky was filming earlier and he woke up for 2 seconds, didn't faze him, and now he's been asleep for another 3 hours.
So yeah. Ben and I were back there and we just heard someone scream. We didn't know what happened.
That's what happened.
Yeah.
Thought somebody broke in.
Yeah.
So before the podcast, we had our guns on the table and everything. Because Logan put us in the hood here, so we're in a little bit of a sketchy area.
Okay, you know what kind of sucks about Airbnbs is that they don't show you the outside or what the neighborhood looks like.
That's true.
Pro tip, if you're going to book an Airbnb, look into the zip code or the neighborhood that you're in before you book it. I mean, it's nice. But
the inside's nice. The outside, little sketch.
I think we should talk about your guys' Q2 experience last night.
That was interesting.
That was fun. I think Ricky's. So Ricky, Dane, and I, so we get here late last night, and Ricky, Dane, and I want snacks, water. I needed a toothbrush, et cetera.
Who forgets a toothbrush?
Well, I don't.
That's the first thing you pack.
I don't like taking it mine from home because I don't want to get back and like have left it at the Airbnb and not have one.
So do you just never take a toothbrush when you
try? No, I will just buy one. I forgot to buy one before I came. Okay. So we hop on these. So as we're walking into this apartment complex or whatever this is that we're staying in, we see that there's these Lime scooters out front, which are very similar to the Bird scooters if you've never seen them. And like 2 days earlier, Ricky showed us this video of this girl like going over the top of the handlebars on a Bird and breaking her jaw or some story about that. And her jaw had to be wired shut. So he's super nervous to get on it. Anyway, the three of us hop on. We zip 700 feet from our Airbnb.
We could have definitely walked it, but
yeah, so. We could have. I'm glad we were on the scooters though.
We got away from the sketchy people faster.
Yeah. It was quite the experience. I don't think I've seen Dane move that fast in a long time.
I'm pretty swift when I need to be. But yeah, when we zip over there, there's a lady. So I've never seen a Quick Trip ever that locks all of its doors except for like one main one.
Yeah.
So they have one point of entry and then they have like things blocking all the other doors inside so people can't get out of them.
The side doors are all locked.
Yeah. And we parked the scooters on the side and we think we're going to walk in the side door. So we jump off the scooters. This lady dips out from like the darkest point behind the Quick
Trip. Bro, where did she even come from?
I don't know.
She was waiting for something.
We're trying to open the, like we try to open the door. She's like, oh, they're always locked. And then she starts following us around the building. And then she's like, hold this. And she's trying to get like, cause there's one cop car sitting in the parking lot and she's trying to give us her backpack. And then she like boxes Ricky out of the door and she's like, take my backpack. And then Ricky just being like the nicest person ever, like can't say no. So he's like doing this number, trying to get around her.
Ricky laughed and I heard him say, what is going on?
Yeah. So that's our original start to our stay here in Tulsa. Then we golfed today. We're actually down here for – did I say that we were down here for the Live Golf Tournament? But we're doing that tomorrow and Sunday.
We'll see the second and third round, which will be good.
Yeah. So, yeah, about 5 minutes before this podcast started, we were debating on what we were going to talk about, what we were going to go over. And Ben, I feel like your family does have a lot of experience in business. What do you think that has? Do you think that's given you an upper leg with stepping out and what you do, just experiencing that stuff, seeing that firsthand? I feel like your dad is a very knowledgeable person.
I mean, yeah, it definitely is more than somebody that wouldn't have seen it. You see a lot of kind of the behind the scenes stuff of owning your business. I think a lot of people think when you own your own business, it's still 9 to 5. You just bring in twice as much money, and that's not the case. And you think about it all the time, and you work the shifts. Whenever somebody calls in, you have to go and do it, no matter what place it's at. You know, if you have multiple locations and somebody in Macon calls in, then you're driving 3 hours to Macon to do that. So that type of stuff you see and realize that there's sacrifices to it. But then also kind of seeing the behind the scenes of the books a little bit helps considerably too in that, I'd say.
Yeah. So obviously you saw that from a very early age growing up with your dad doing all of that. And obviously it impacted your work ethic and shaped you into the person that you are. What was your thought process growing up with seeing that on like owning your own business? Did that kind of sway you one way, sway you the other?
Well, I mean, growing up, I always wanted to do the pharmacy thing. Like, I wanted to take it over and stuff until I kind of saw later in my teen years how things were shifting whenever, you know, the big pharma got more powerful, and just decided that wasn't something I wanted to do. I didn't want to work for CVS. I have several friends right now that work for CVS, and it's, I mean, every other weekend, 50 hours a week, and you make okay money, but you're just a number to them. So I decided that wasn't something I wanted to do. I don't think the helping people is quite the same, which is what I decided early on in college that I didn't want to do. And also I didn't like chemistry. That's probably
organic chemistry was not fun.
I also didn't like chemistry.
Yeah. I think big pharma, I think that space has changed a lot. And how did your dad navigate going into that? Because I think it's hard as being a business owner and you have all these people rely on you, because how many pharmacies did you guys have?
So I think there were 17 total retail stores and then 2 long-term cares that they still have.
So you have 17 of these stores. I know probably one of the hardest decisions he's ever made in his life was having all these people that rely on him that he goes to sell to CVS, which a lot of those people probably still work for CVS and things like that. But that's, I'm assuming, was a...
Yeah,
no, monster decision for him.
Yeah, that was something. I saw the purchase agreement go back and forth 17 times between CVS and Red Cross and stuff. He didn't ever want to sell, I don't think, because he doesn't like
big pharma.
Big pharma. I mean, it's just not what he thinks the care should be. So he argued the purchase agreement and stuff. He didn't want to sell at all, but I think the numbers were ultimately just too great, and he could see the writing on the wall that they can buy it or they can take it, kind of thing. But it was definitely hard. I mean, I remember him having to go to every store and tell them and stuff. Not a ton of people that worked for Red Cross still work for him because of the stuff I mentioned. I mean, you know, it's hard to call CVS and say, hey, my kid's got a recital at 4:30 today. Can I get off? They don't give a damn.
I think that just comes with the corporate world in general that I think that I watch it from industries everywhere. And I mean, that's why we stay out of a lot of the corporate marketing space. It is all just numbers to them. There's no personal touch to it. You can have that relationship with that person here, there, up that may be a decision maker, but realistically, I feel like a lot of times decisions aren't made out of doing the right thing by people. It's, hey, this makes sense if we eliminate this person from every one of these facilities, put it through, just get these people eliminated. And you don't know it's somebody that it's a single mom that has 3 kids that she's trying to take care of, that she's working as many hours as she can. She's trying to pick up extra shifts.
Yeah.
And it's like, to them, that money maybe just be a drop in the bucket.
Yeah.
But they're just so, I think when people just get so built into looking at P&Ls all the time, they lose sight of like what business really is.
Yeah.
And what got them to that point.
Yeah. And as an accountant, I'm kind of,
I feel like even if decision makers do, you know, care about, you know, their employees' well-being and stuff, at the end of the day, whatever's best for business is the final factor. They probably don't want to make that decision, but everyone up the chain is like that. I mean, that's what has to happen. So,
yeah.
I mean, even if it is, you know, they're like, I don't want to do this, but they're probably still going to do it. They're going to make that decision regardless.
There's definitely business decisions that have to be made sometimes. I mean, yeah. I've made some very uncomfortable decisions since I've started this, and is it what you want to do at the time? Absolutely not. And I know what your dad took on is a whole different beast than.
And I'll say there's a huge difference there, though. The tough decisions that you've had to make, you made them be thinking about the overall well-being and overarching goal of everyone within the company and how the situation was hindering the progression towards that goal. I think it's a little bit different with the corporate world because they are so based on numbers, performance, metrics, all of that type of stuff. So still very tough decisions. But I think you're in a much better place to make those decisions, or you're making them based off of a much better, thing.
You also always, I mean, any business owner that's out there, you always have to watch those metrics. You always have to watch those KPIs. You always have to watch those things for like growth of business moving forward. And I'm not saying don't do that.
Yeah.
I'm also saying though that there is a personal piece that plays in that you look at what Google has done, taking care of their people. They've built these campuses and like Ben was talking about North Point bringing in food every day. I've been at a meeting at North Point where it was lunchtime and everyone's going out. I'm like, that's the coolest thing. Mm-hmm. But it's like, and North Point's not that old of a company.
2012.
Yeah. So it's like that company has blown up, but it's also like you just saw a culture difference there. And they have the old Cerner building mm-hmm. over there off North Oak. Yeah. And when you're there looking at it, it's like the culture, like it's not like a business owner comes in and says, hey, if I'm going to feed all these people every single day, that's going to make me a bunch of money. No, that's just a net out negative.
Yeah.
But that's saying, hey, how can I make these people's lives better every day? How am I bringing more to the table that their work environment's better than the next person?
Yeah.
That somebody may come along and you're going to have great talent that comes through somewhere. And they say, hey, if this person comes through and offers them $5,000 more, they're like, well, you know what? I do get lunch here every single day of the week and everything like that. Like, so there's other factors that play into that.
Yeah.
And
yeah, it's so smart. It's such a, it's such a hack for employers and leaders. I mean, I don't understand why more people don't do stuff like that to try and retain good talent. Like the cost that you have and go through as an employer or a leader or a team, whatever situation you're in with replacing an employee, if you would have just done a little bit more to keep the good employees that you had and make sure they're taken care of, you know, you do go the little extra mile, it's going to lead to better productivity from your employees. They're going to be happier and you're not going to have the churn, the replacement cost.
The last corporate company that I worked at, they did hardly anything to retain employees. I mean, honestly, their raise structure was pretty poor. And I mean, basically the only incentive I can think about that we ever got was when our regional manager would come in, which he was there quite a bit, but he would usually buy lunch when he was there. But that wasn't them saying to do that. That was his decision. So, I mean, yeah, it's in the corporate space, it's,
Yeah, it's always something that's so, irrelevant. It's almost, at least for me, when I was at Hallmark, I had 300 people underneath me, and I would try to think of things to do like this, and I would go present this to our upper management and stuff. And they were, I will say, they were pretty good about like at least working with it and kind of letting me do some stuff, but it was always a factor of, okay, what's the cost for this going to be? How much work time is this going to interrupt? And this type of stuff. And then when we did that type of stuff, that's the only time our employees would see our upper management was when they were providing lunch or they were coming to do something like, oh, wow, look at me. I'm providing this, and the employees almost saw it as a joke. They're like, oh, you guys are only here because you want to you know, save face or show off, or you're about to make a big announcement that isn't in our favor. So yeah.
I think just a little bit of a showing face, you know, telling people they're doing a good job, that kind of thing goes along. Like it's things that like we overlook as people, but like giving people, you know, what word am I looking for?
Recognition
yeah. for things. We like for someone like me, like it's not something I need. Like I don't need someone to tell me that, but other people don't think like that. And I think the majority don't.
Yeah.
So I think it's often overlooked is like higher management. Like, hey, just give your employees a little recognition, mm-hmm. let them know you appreciate them. I think it really helps the morale in places yeah. like that, because where I was at before, like it was, I mean, I never saw anyone in upper management.
Yeah.
Ever. Or the only time I would see him or would hear from him would be like an email. And usually that email was like a bad,
mm-hmm.
email.
Yeah.
I think that's also just a leadership trait. That yep. it's these people get to these management levels, they get this name tag that they have, and they think that they're better than the next person. That it's yeah. I know people that own corporate companies that are large that know every single person that works for them. And I know guys that have 300 plus employees in a place, 400 plus employees in a place, and they go in there and they can walk their floors and they know every mm-hmm. single person that works there. Yep. But it's because like they're in there all the time. It's not like they've made it to a spot that they're like, oh, I'm too good to go talk to the guy that's doing this. Like
that
it's,
and their morale is probably pretty good. Their employee morale.
But it's also, that's why you see like the people I know in that space, I mean, are unbelievably successful.
Yeah. The leaders that excel in those environments are the ones who aren't afraid to either, if it's a production environment or something like that, either A, go help their employees when, you know, times are tough or they're in the trenches, like get alongside them. That's huge. Kind of leader, yeah. There. Yeah. And that's, I mean,
but also like, so what is your dad still in the pharmacy space? Some correct.
Yeah. So he still does the long-term care stuff.
So he does long-term care stuff. And we were just talking yesterday and Ben was asking me how many miles are on my truck. And I've had it for like, I don't know, like less than a year, close to a year. I was like, yeah, it's like right at 15,000. He's like, oh, damn, my dad's truck's like 30,000. And I was like, I'm pretty sure he got his after me.
Yeah,
he's
late
like,
October. This yeah. is mid-May.
I'm like doing the math in my head. I'm like, 26. How the hell did he put that many miles on it? Well, he's like, he's driving out to here doing all this. And it's like, but his face is being seen at those places. Yeah. Like no, he shows up.
Yeah, I remember like whenever I was real little, I was like undercover boss. Came out and I thought that was pretty cool. And I told my dad, I was like, you should go do this. And he's like, well, I can't. He's like, everybody knows me. Like, I can't.
Yeah.
He's like, yeah. I can't do it. He's like, I might have 300 employees, but I can't.
I feel like that's
pretty cool.
When I saw, I watched that show growing up too. And I thought that was just like the coolest thing. But it's also, how crazy is it that there's people out there that have a company that can go hit all these different branches of what they have and not a single person even recognizes who they are?
Yeah.
I mean, their disguises, I feel like, are okay, but I don't feel like they're that mind blowing.
Yeah. I will say it's a little different when you've got locations in 50 states. I mean, you've got thousands on thousands of employees.
Yeah, no, that was 10 year old me asking, well, why don't you go do this?
Yeah. Or even some of them are probably multinational.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very, very true.
But it's like, I think if you had, this is just me, like, if I had restaurants, if I was opening restaurants, if I was doing that, like, every time they're opening, like, I'm wanting to do something cool. Like, I feel like those are just staples of like you're building something so much bigger than yourself. Like, is every single person there going to know you? Maybe not. Like, if you get to that level, but it's also, I know people that own a lot of McDonald's and like they have still a huge relationship with the majority of the people that work there. Like, but it's, they have good staffing, they have good managers, they have those people, but it's like they follow that leader. And I think a lot of the corporate space just has missed the boat on that leadership space now.
And where I work now, North Point, I mean, I don't think the upper management knows everybody because there's 1,300 employees. It's just impossible. But in your first couple months of onboarding, you have Zoom calls with all of them. I mean, you know well who the chief executive officers are and stuff. You can figure out.
So their main office is where you work.
Yeah. Right?
And then do they have offices around the country or?
They do have a couple, but they're pretty small, I think, outside of KC. I mean, KC is the main home office and the other ones are just kind of smaller satellites.
I still feel that was, it's what, 11 year old company.
Yeah.
And I mean,
11 years, 1,300 employees.
I mean, they opened when we graduated high school. So.
Yeah, that's huge.
Yeah. No, I think, I mean, they have real estate all over. But yeah, the main office is in KC, and Nathaniel, the guy who opened it, I think he was in real estate and like Briarcliff and stuff and wanted to branch out on his own and just develop North Point. And over the last, so they've been open, I guess, 11 years, the last 5 or 6, I think, is really where it's gone.
Yeah.
Skyrocketed on them.
But I think that's also just doing something that you know works and trusting the process of what you're doing. And they haven't got there by accident. And it's he has the right people around him.
Yeah.
I know multiple people that work for North Point, and it's like, I mean, they acquire top level talent.
Yeah.
And it's not like,
yeah,
it's not like I've met anybody that like, oh yeah, we're from North Point. Like they're
not afraid to pay and they're not afraid to give benefits. And
yeah. But I think that's what you get in today's world. You either pay A players or you pay B players.
You get what you pay for.
Most of the time, when people think that they're paying a little bit less for a B player, it takes like 3 or 4 B players to get the quality of a good A player.
Yeah.
And it's sometimes it's just biting that bullet saying, like, I need, like, if you just hire A players, it's crazy how much quicker business moves. It's crazy how much faster things evolve and push forward. And it's, but it's just, taking that bite, saying, hey, you know what, I'm not
– yeah.
If I hire this B player, then it's
– yeah.
That actually takes us backwards.
Yeah. You hire 2 B players for $50,000 and 1 A player for $90,000.
Yeah.
It's just a different level of thinking. Like, it, we talk about it a lot with, like, having an abundance mindset. Like, there's so much out there. You have to just go after it and realize that – you're going to get there faster if you get A players rather than if you get B players. And
so my biggest thing that I did not understand when I started business was actually how fast business can evolve. Like, I truly didn't understand that with the right people by my side, how fast things could actually move forward. So I always had this just thought in my head of like the, oh, Dre's awake.
He's awake.
Dre. What's up, dude?
So I always had this, like, when I originally first opened up Moss Marketing Group, I sat there with this idea of, like, how fast it would move forward with – and it's almost like it's the same thing they talk about on betting on golf. Like, we'll bring it back to that when you're like, you want to bet a penny a hole, and then we double it every single time. Or would you rather bet $1,000 a hole? Everyone's like, well, I'd rather bet the penny than double it or whatever. Or is it a dollar and double it or –
it's something like that.
It's something whatever. Really small. I think it's a dollar, and then you double it every time, whatever. But you end up like the last 3 or 4 holes, you're betting like huge money.
The last hole ends up being like 13 grand, and the one I sold or something like that.
I don't know the exact numbers behind all of it, but it's crazy how fast that doubling that happens. To where when I started everything, the numbers I configured in my head and when I wrote down goals, and I was like, this is what I can do in a month. So if I can do this in 6 months, this is where I'll be. If I can keep that going, then here's at 12 months, and this is 3 years, this is 5 years. But then I figured out that what took me 30 days to do, once I hired somebody, was done in 15. So I'm like, oh, we're getting a whole month's work done in half the time. But there's 2 of us.
Yeah.
So then I hire a third person, and then all of a sudden it's getting done in a third of the time. And then it's like, now all of a sudden with 12 people, it's things are getting done 12 times faster. And the people that are actually doing that stuff are more efficient than I am. So it's like, I think that's the exact same thing that probably happened with North Point, is they probably thought this line going like this. But now think about having 1,300 people, how fast things get done. You pass that. I look at when I pass the 365 people working for me, I am now getting a year worth of growth done in a day.
Yeah.
So I'm moving years in a week.
Yeah.
So if I'm sitting thinking about, and that's where I think entrepreneurs, that's the difference between an entrepreneur and a small business owner. a small business owner never looks at what scale looks like at the fullest level.
Yeah.
That look at if I have 365 people that are giving me a year of time in a single day, how fast do you move a company forward? Yeah. That like North Point's going to do nothing but keep getting bigger. It's snowballing. And it's like you start looking at that time about how fast things happen.
Yeah.
That I look at when I had like five accounts and I thought I was up to my eyeballs and I was like going to drown and everything. And now I look at 100 plus accounts and I'm like, I feel like we're actually handling these pretty easily. I was like, but it's just the same thing when you just look at that from that perspective.
Yeah.
That your dad had enough people that he was doing a year's worth of work daily.
Yeah. Yeah. No. When you have 13 stores, obviously it requires that many people.
Yeah.
Or 15 or whatever they had. It requires that many people to just run the thing too, which I think that's what North Point is struggling with now, at least in the accounting department that I see with it's, it does require so many people just to run the thing. But then giving everybody the appropriate tasks and stuff is
yeah.
Scaling is hard. You have to
the organization, and, the processes, yeah. the procedures.
Yeah. yeah. You can have the people, but how you delegate is equally as important.
Processes, procedures, organization, and delegating when in business.
Yeah. And that's how you scale something. That's how you take something from 10 employees to 1300.
But that's like where you hit that spot. Like I talk about it all the time that I'm focusing on things that are not even relevant what we do in today's space. Like the things I'm focused on every day, we have fully handled the way that we currently do it. And I'm sitting there thinking about a different way to do it. And it's like, I definitely see where probably a lot of people, even within our company, are like, why the fuck is he working on this right now? Like, why are we wasting our time doing this? But it's not for when there's 12 of us right now. It's for when there's 26 of us.
Yeah.
It's for when there's 50 of us that if this process isn't fixed now, you know how hard it is to implement a process with 1300 people probably? That is, think about the money burn to try to implement that.
No, they're changing the accounting process right now from development to stabilized opposed to just regions.
Yeah.
We had a West, a Central, a Midwest, and a West, and now they're changing it to in construction versus.
So you sit there and you look at if I have, say you have 1300 employees and they're paid, if they're paid salary or they're paid hourly, however you pay them, you can break down a salary employee to what they get paid an hour and say that you have to put every single one of those people through training for this new process that you put in place. It may cost you, I don't know, I'm $100,000 just to put people through training.
Oh, it's
hundreds of thousands.
It's millions. Much farther than that. So at Hallmark, the big thing that we were working on when I was at Hallmark or starting to work on was automation. So the way that like Hallmark worked in the distribution center was there was, you know, say we'll just, these aren't the actual numbers, but say there's 20,000 different cards or items, products that ship to a store. Individual employees that worked at the facility I was at, they would go around to these bin locations and pick and put in the box for a specific order that would ship to a store anywhere in the U.S. or anywhere that a Hallmark products were sold. We were working on implementing like automation, different style, like picking to where they had a headset on. It told them where to go and stuff like that. The amount of money that was spent and just the time and the volume of like meetings, all this stuff, the spend on it gets into the millions and millions.
Oh yeah.
And millions.
Like but they are thinking that there's a time where you can sit there and say, hey, I'm going to spend $1 million, but it's going to end up saving me five next year.
And
most people
that's
like
why you do it.
And that's why you do those things. But it's always like, how efficiently do you run a business? And that comes with organization. Process comes from how organized are you running?
Yeah.
Like how organized are the 100 people that you have or the 300 people you have? If you can sit there and look at how you can optimize, like we talk about all the time in our business model, how much time we waste on like what content needs to be done and shit like that. You gotta go fucking pee.
Just smoked his head on the light.
No, but it's like we talk about how much time is wasted on when content needs to be done, when different things like that need to be done. And it's if we automate that process to where it's never missed, there's no broken piece in it, and there's no meetings to be had about when that needs to be done, and it's all streamlined into one individual software that runs it all. Now, how much time do we as a company save over a year? How much more efficiently did we just get? Because we could say, hey, on the 12 people we have, we can now take on 5 more accounts because we're not setting this time aside to plan all this out. We just pulled all those people back into what they were doing. And then we didn't lose money. We just became that much more profitable because of that one process. And then we just became that much more efficient to be able to say, hey, now this number of people can run this many accounts. But I don't even want to know what a process implement looks like at 1,300 people. But
and there's positions, there's legitimate positions in corporate companies that do this, that their title, that there's teams that do this called change managers that are just like focused on getting people to like cope with change and like evolve from the way that they used to work. Because like it's easy for like high level thinking individuals to understand and grasp the concept like, hey, we're going to spend $8 million. We're going to completely shift, go 90 degrees the other way, and it's going to interrupt everything that we do. But in 10 years, it's going to save us $10 million a year. It is hard to get employees to think on that mindset and realize that this is going to make your life easier. This is going to make your job easier. It just sucks right now. There's an entire team out there that are just change managers.
I think most of the time in the corporate world too, when that change is happening in certain companies, like I think North Point, like I was saying, you have a lot of A-level players. So a lot of them probably understand it.
Yeah.
But I think in a company like Hallmark, where you have a lot of people that are hourly warehouse workers, stuff like that, when you implement change, they think it's all about trying to screw them.
Yeah, and it is hard, though. Some of these people have been there for 35 years, and that literally their life, their work has been the same for 30-plus years, and they love it. They love what they do, and they don't want to change. Like, that's the hard part about it.
I think individuals that, like, never want to change, and it's – I mean, I saw it in the car space, and it's almost pretty sad that there's all these guys that prospered in the car world through the 90s into early 2000s, and computers and internet ran them to extinction. And that these weren't guys that they were living the high life through that time. They weren't putting money in 401ks. They weren't putting money in retirement accounts. They weren't doing that stuff. These guys are still working today in their 70s even. Like, and they're going to have to work till the day they die. But it's like the car space has passed them. It's evolved right past them. It's like if you don't change with stuff, then it's going to evolve beyond you. It's like we watch the same thing with content creators in our world right now where they live by landscape video. And it's like landscape video has its place. If I want to run a Facebook ad with a landscape video and that's all I'm going to do with it, and I just want it crazy high level, all right, great. If you want to evolve a business, you have to get with portrait video. And there's all these content creators like that they believe that they know better than the algorithm, that they are going to bring change back to content, bring it back to landscape. Like, no, you're getting fucking left behind and the space is going to evolve and you're not going to have a job. And you're going to wonder why. It's because you didn't evolve with the space. And you didn't keep up with what's happening.
Yeah.
And that's in any space, like jumping out of Red Cross because Big Pharma is doing what they're doing. The space has evolved.
Yeah.
The game has changed.
Yeah.
You're not playing the same game anymore.
No. And the pharmacy game is a little bit different because you can't play the game.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Somebody's throwing 100 miles an hour, you just can't, you know, compared to baseball, you know, I mean, if you're playing high school, you know, you'd be great, but people start throwing 100, you just can't compete. Yeah. That's kind of where the pharmacy world went, but.
Yeah. So your hat. Something that I feel like you guys have leaned into a little bit more recently is the farming side. So you guys also, so for those who don't know, obviously they kind of own some farms, land, work in that environment. I think you're kind of trying to build that up and develop that. Talk a little bit about what you're doing with that.
Yeah. So the farms, I mean, the farms are what I like way more than the pharmacy. Now the pharmacy subsidize some of the farms to begin with, from an income perspective. But, I mean, I have the mindset that they don't make any more land and it's not getting any cheaper. I mean, you know, whatever company can create more stock or divide stocks, whatever, you can't make more land, period. With that, the land prices have gone pretty insane lately, so it's hard to grow a whole lot. When beans are, you know, $15 and corn is north of $6, it's a little easier to justify paying, you know, $15,000 an acre for some of the bottom land along the Missouri River bottom, I guess, to specify for the listeners that aren't around Missouri. But the Malta Bend and Lafayette and Saline County land, that's
the prime land.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you'll see that go for $15,000-$20,000 an acre. Yeah.
Which I think
water's pretty important.
I think that the farming space is changing too. Like, I feel like you have big players in the farming space that continue. Like,
you do.
They have the capital, and they say, "Hey, they're like."
Yeah, you see a lot of private equity now throwing money at land.
Yeah,
and driving the prices up.
And it's. I also think it's our generation coming, that you have this new generation of farmer that. You had grandpa, you had dad, that this is the way grandpa did it all the time. He had this many acres, he always did. Son starts, he says, "Hey, this is the land that we've always done. This is what we do. This is how dad told me to live off the money." They were able to do it. And then the last, our generation coming up, the last 10 years, we've seen more of a inflation than ever before. The inflation rate's climbing. Yeah. And it's now there's this new young generation that has watched the online space. They've watched what people have done. They've watched people grow into millionaires, and they say, "Hey, dad, what if we take all this land that we have free and clear, we go leverage it with a bank and we buy more land?" Like you said, they don't make more of it.
Yeah.
And then it's like, there's some of these guys that have a ton of land.
Yeah. So when we buy a farm, we try to set it up so we put the money down on it, you know, and then pretty much the farm pays for itself or makes all the payments on itself going forward and then kicks them back. I think the new generation is a little less scared of debt too, which is a big thing. I think the interest rates currently might screw that up a little bit, but I think that's where you've really seen the boom in the last 4 or 5 years from land come. I mean, land that was selling for $1,750 an acre in Northeast Ray County is now going for $4,500, $5,000 an acre.
Yeah.
I mean, which, just asinine. And it's not worth anything other than hunting land. And people are still just paying it. I think that's just a reflection of interest rates and
money. And that's I was talking to a farmer I know up north. We were up filming a bunch of stuff for him, and he said that he goes, this new generation just knows how to leverage money different than he goes, we were never taught anything along that lines, but it's like we have the internet at our disposal now. And not everyone's doing it. Like, I'm not fearful of debt whatsoever. I'm only fearful of debt if I trade my time for it. Which that's where people our age are looking at things, that you can go buy this Airbnb that we're sitting in. This place didn't cost anything crazy. We're going over what we're paying for it, and there's what, I don't know, 4 or 6 units here.
Yeah.
If they're booking out every weekend and they own the whole place, like they're making
they're paying their whole month in a month.
Yeah, they're paying their whole month in a weekend. And then it's like you look at somebody that's older than us that they're like, "Well, you don't want to have that."
Yeah, no.
Dead out on that place.
There's two ways to look at it. So, like, it's very similar farming, real estate, whatever you're buying property. You can either look at it like, "Hey, I'm in debt for $1 million," or like, "Oh my God, that's so scary. I owe someone like $1 million. We'll just use that for an equal number." Or you can look at it like, "Okay, yeah, I'm in debt for $1 million, but it's good debt because that makes me $7,000 a month. And I know if I manage it right, it'll be paid off eventually, and I'm never going to have to stress about it."
Think about acquiring assets and having other people pay for it. That's where our generation has came into a whole new space. And I'm not saying it's only our generation. There's still a lot of people that are older than us that have done things way better than we have. But
there's still a lot of people in our generation that view it as a bad thing, as scary. And debt is a buzzword that used to be taught, and still in a certain degree is taught, as a negative connotation.
Well, you have Dave Ramsey out there that's telling everyone that it's like, pay everything off that you have. And it's like, Dave Ramsey isn't building millionaires. Dave Ramsey's building a bunch of people that run fucking scared to keep a stack of fucking envelopes with cash in them that they're trying to pay off like they're
– that just work until they're 65, retire like, for 10, 15 years, he and is, you die.
His philosophy that he has is keep people in the rat race.
Yeah.
And he talks about that he's trying to help people get out of it. The fuck are you talking about? You were trying to get people to live at the lowest point that they can. You aren't teaching people how to acquire more money. When we talk about that abundance mindset, that there's plenty of money out there. I was just in Vegas and I'm watching people play blackjack with $1,000 of fucking hand. Okay, so these people are now Dave Ramsey's out there saying that like that's your house payment or whatever. You shouldn't have that, blah, blah, blah. Like he's telling you. So what these people didn't listen to Dave?
I will say there's certain demographics out there that absolutely like just cannot manage money and need that like guidance. So he's speaking to a certain demographic, but I do agree.
But he acts like he's speaking to everyone.
Yeah. No, that's the problem.
I think I could be wrong in this, but I think a lot of financiers now say like, why would you leverage your money when you can leverage someone else's? Why would you spend your money when you can use someone else's?
Which when rates are low, that's always low, like rates are low. Yeah. Buy as much as you want, like because if you're leveraging money at 2%, like that's a no brainer. It's pretty easy to make. Like anybody can make over 2% on their money.
Yeah.
So you take if you have liquid money that you current like, why would you go pay that off? But it's there are people out there that don't understand it, but it's also like. I don't think that's an excuse in today's world with the internet in front of us. Those people just haven't chosen to read books. They haven't chosen to get on the internet, to watch videos, to figure out how to actually use money. Yeah. And it's if you're shitty with money, that's on you.
Yeah.
Plain and simple.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. The only Dave Ramsey principle I really agree with is kind of the live within your means to a degree.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, pay off all your notes. Don't go in credit card debt.
Yeah.
I mean, stuff like that.
There are good principles.
Investment debt is different than...
Personal debt you can get in trouble with.
Yeah.
So that is correct. All debts, if you're out like leveraging yourself into boats and.
We're speaking from business terms. Using debt for investment.
From a business aspect, I think debt is not a bad word at all. Mm-hmm. I think it is something that has. I think a lot of companies have, like we talk about it all the time, with. I've sat with people that I'm like, you have a fire going with your company. You're like getting a little bit of traction. And I'm like, if you got marketing going and you actually increase the exposure level on your business, like, well, I really just don't have the cash flow to do it.
Go take a line.
Invest if somebody was talking to me, I would say, I'll invest in myself. I'll go get a line of credit and I'll pay you for 12 months up front. And guess what? It's go time.
Yeah.
Like, I would be the first one to do that. Because I believe in what I do. I believe in everybody around me. I believe in that I have no problem doing that. I did that with Moss Marketing Group.
Yeah.
I went and pulled a line of credit and I said, hey, I went to the bank. I said, I actually got a non-collateral line at less than 5%. So I felt like that was fine.
Yeah.
But it's like they gave me a non-collateral line and I said, hey, this is Moss Marketing Group capital for marketing. That's all I put it at. Mm. It wasn't like because in business you can really start divvying money across a million different things.
Yeah.
Really quick. And you say, hey, I can bring on more employees, I can do all these different things. But I'm like, what brings us business quickest and elevates us in the space? And it's was the marketing aspect, which is exactly what we do for other companies, which is really what catapulted us into what we are today. To where it's like I will always look back at that line of credit was what got us to where we are.
Yeah.
And it was a $50,000 line. It wasn't like it was anything astronomical, but it was just like it was something that just got our name out there that got people to know who we were really quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I feel like we're beating a dead horse at this point, like with the we always talk about it, but it's so true and it rings like there's the mindset of abundance versus like the small business owner that it's just a passion project. Like when you're truly running a business and you have goals for it and you want to take it to a certain level, like you think that way. It's just like I don't know how you get people to think.
I don't know. I think
how you transfer that.
I think if we could answer that question, we'd
make a lot of money.
Yeah, none of us would be sitting this day rich as hell.
Yeah.
And I feel like, I don't know, it's hard to give people a drive, because I think that's truly inside what it is, that when I lay in bed at night and I read on marketing, that's a drive that's like inside me that just makes me want to be the best I am at that.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know how your head works. I don't know how Ben's head works. I don't know how Dalton's head works. Like, I don't know how anyone else thinks or like processes things. I don't know what makes somebody want to do something. I don't know how that all works. And I don't know how to like, how people like, you can go, there's so many people that go to these hoorah coaching deals. Like, we have a coaching group, and it's also like, you're only going to get out of it what you want to get out of it. And that, like,
that's the case with anything in life.
And we sat a huge event with a lot of huge money guys standing on stage, and they're talking. They're like, we're going to go over so much of this stuff. And like, 90% of the people in here aren't going to do anything with it.
Yeah.
And I sat there. I'm like, I know the motherfucker ain't talking to me. I know I'm not at 90%. Like,
I'm in the 10,
but it's just like, I knew that like right out the gate. I'm like, that's why I spent a ticket to fly halfway across the country, was to get this knowledge. Like, I want that. Like, I want to elevate myself in everything I do, but it's like, I don't know how to get somebody else to do that. Like, I don't know how you jumpstart someone else to do that. How you get someone to, like, I feel that with what Ben, you and your dad have done, like, I think a lot of times when someone's parents are really successful, a lot of times it skips a generation.
Yeah.
And it's pretty common. And it's like, I don't feel like it skipped yours. Like, I don't feel like it skipped a beat at all.
Yeah.
So it's, I don't know what your dad did. Like, same thing with Dre and I think there's so many times people are like, oh, you came from money, you probably don't have a work ethic, like any of this stuff. And I'm like, I'll outwork anybody in a room.
Yeah. It's I think it's the mindset a little bit that you don't come from money. And I think that's what they instill in you. Like, you don't have anything. Like, you're going to work at 14, you know, you're going to run the cash register type thing. And just that mindset that you don't come from this. I mean, you don't have this. I don't have to leave any of this to you, and I don't expect any of that from it per se. I think,
and that's something like our dad always told us. Like, I remember I was probably in like eighth grade or something. I said something, and I was like, you know what? I'm like, we really have some money. Or I said something like that. My dad goes, he goes, I have money. He goes, you don't have shit. And he's like, and then I'm like. And it was funny, like, it was at a young age, and I just remember thinking about, I'm like, no, he's right. I don't have anything.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have two fucking pennies rubbed together. I'm like, at that point, I was like, if he gave me $100, like, I would go out and mow and stuff, and I'd get $100. And I'm like, that shit was gone within 24 hours of getting it. Like, we didn't have anything. Yeah.
Some parents just don't raise their kids like that, though. Yeah. I mean, it's like they raise them to be, like, entitled.
Like, and I feel like people even do it with less money. No, like,
well, sure.
Yeah. That they act like they're entitled to something. And I think it's a lot of times in a lot of these people in the corporate space that they work their way up. They got to management, and they're like, you know, fucking dad's a high fluting motherfucker at work. Mom's a high fluting motherfucker at work. Like, you don't know like who we are. Like,
yeah.
It's like they think, and I think that's also people that just, a lot of times you see it with leadership when people have never had it. And it's like, I talk to Madison about it all the time. Like, I can read people that have been leaders their whole lives, and I can read people that have never led anyone. When they get in that leadership position, they are so hungry. They have to tell everyone that they're a leader. They have to, like, get fucking mean to people. They have to, like, really,
assert
like...
assert their dominance.
They really, like, can't wait to do it.
Yeah.
And it's like...
it's a power trip.
It really is. Like, you watch these power trips happen, then it's... you watch somebody that's like ran from a successful position. You've watched people like they're calm, they're cool, they're collective. Like, things don't knock them off their feet. Like, they're composed all the time. And it's, they don't go after everyone underneath them. It's they think about things. Even when I started Moss Marketing Group, like, I've matured so much in 3 years from when I started on just certain things that used to be like, I let emotions play a game with me.
Yeah,
that you have to take that piece of it out. And when something happens, you're not making an emotional decision towards it. Yeah. You're making a business decision. And I'm going to say there's still we're talking about how there's the human factor in it.
Yeah.
that you still keep that side of it, but it's also like when that happens, it's don't make a rash emotional decision.
Exactly.
Something.
It depends on what you're talking about, but if you can take the emotions out of most of your decision making in life, you will be so successful that you can't even see straight.
Yeah.
But, so
no, go for it.
Talking about the parents thing. So my perspective on it is that the internet changed things so much. So for our parents and our grandparents' generation and our parents with us, they taught their kids and future generations only what they knew. Like you couldn't teach your kids something that you didn't comprehend or know. The internet comes around and that changes things completely, because a 13-year-old now that's like, okay, what's life? What do I want to do with my life? They have a cell phone in their hand.
Outside influence.
They have outside influence. It's not just what mom and dad are telling me. It's, okay, I find a Grant Cardone on YouTube. I find a Bradley. I find these people who know more than my parents. And they have the ability now to elevate their family. We talk about Ed Milet always talks about being that transitional person in your bloodline. Like, there's more of an opportunity now for kids to do that than there ever has been in history.
I think we talked about that like half the drive down here.
Mm-hmm.
Actually was like the opportunities that are in front of us now that people just have to open up their eyes to see them.
Yeah.
Like we have so much in front of us. We have more in front of us than we've ever had before. But it's like we have like, I think college is useless now unless you are going for a specialty type degree. If you were going to be a doctor, a lawyer, do you need an accounting degree for everything? Or
it helps.
Accounting, yeah.
It might. Like, but what I'm saying is nowadays with the internet out there, I mean, you can get some pretty crazy, like I look at what Dalton and I learned in college. We could probably buy some online class and learn probably 90%.
Yeah.
Every bit.
I feel like
in field work has, but it's also like, I look at so much in the marketing space. I think a marketing degree is worth no more than this fucking empty beer can.
I don't want to say that.
No, but yeah. Like, well, we don't
know. You can say that, bro.
Finance and accounting are about the only business degree.
Yeah.
Economics, like, so, maybe if you leverage it right.
But so many people go and they get a marketing degree, and these institutions and universities are selling people that they need that to go into the space, but they have some person to teach in marketing that hasn't done marketing since the fucking 90s.
Yeah.
And it's like, Dre and I went and talked to our high school marketing class. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, what'd you guys learn in college and marketing and everything? I'm like, neither one of us went to school for marketing.
Nothing.
And they're like, but it's, we have people teaching marketing that have never actually done marketing.
Yeah.
So how is that like a thing? Like people that go to teach at universities, I feel like there's specialty spots in like, my fiance, her mom was a math teacher forever, and she is phenomenal at math, like over the top, but she loves, like, she just has a knack for it. But I feel like in the business space, people that fail at business go to teach. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
I feel that, like, at least at the university we came from.
You can tell what professors are there because they couldn't get a job in the real world.
Exactly.
Yeah. Real world versus which.
And they said, hey, I could come here, I could teach, like, and then they teach the same shit over and over and over. Yeah. And then it's that person that's terrified of change.
Mm-hmm.
And then so they're teaching the same shit. And guess what? 5 years, it's different. And they're still teaching. They're not
6 months.
Well, still. They're not out in the world doing it.
Yeah.
So it's like they don't see the change in it. They don't have a company that's coming to them saying, hey, we're going to cancel our $20,000 a month marketing if we don't get some shit turned around. They're collecting money from a bunch of students that are coming there that think that they're learning something, and they're just giving them unwilling checks. And then it's like, I get out of college, why can't I get a job?
Yeah.
I've turned down almost, I think to date, almost every single marketing degree that's came into our marketing group has demanded more money than any other person that's walked in to start. They're the only people that haven't been willing to bet on themselves.
Yeah.
That they say they demand this much because they have this fucking piece of paper. And guess what? I have a piece of paper that sits on my wall too, and it doesn't do shit for me. I pay $141 a month for it, and that's it. But it's like once that paper is paid off, I'm taking it down.
Yeah.
I don't.
It's like I literally do not care about it. It's like it does nothing for me.
I don't even know where mine's at.
Mine's in a closet, I think.
Yeah. No one's ever asked to see mine either.
No.
So I had a friend reach out to me this week on social media that used to be or was a teacher. And they're like, I'm leaving the education space and I want to get into marketing. Do you have any like college degrees? I'm going to go back to school and get a marketing degree. Do you have any like specific recommendations and courses or like certifications that I can get? And I was like, to be honest with you, none of us have a marketing degree. And the reason why is because it shifts so fast. The stuff that works right now isn't going to work 6 months from now. It's constantly evolving and it's just not valuable. But I also told the person I can't speak for other marketing companies because we run very different. We look at things, we hire and look at things based on work ethic, your mindset.
I also, as other companies. I try to run a company with our eyes wide open. I'm not going to. And also, if somebody comes to me with a marketing degree and they can sit there and justify why they are worth that money and what their marketing degree and what they learned, why they bring that value, I'm all fucking ears.
Yeah.
100%. But it's also, I feel like great marketers in our world are innovators. That it's just somebody that has a mind that is willing to look at a different position in a space. That's what makes a great marketer.
And step out in confidence and be on the leading edge of what we're doing.
Well, I think it's even the same for probably everything. I mean, if you're an accountant or a pharmacist for CVS and you put 30 pills in a bottle and give it to the person, it's whatever. But, you know, it's about the person more than the degree. I mean, if I can look at a general ledger and think, well, this should be here and why didn't we have this and stuff like that and why aren't we doing this instead and stuff like that, you can advance yourself further. That's important.
Yeah. And
the person is more important than the degree.
And I think like being in a pharmacy, that's something that you have to have a degree for.
Yeah.
I feel like you very much should have a degree.
Yeah. For that. You know, there's obviously a knowledge base that you have to understand why this debit does this and this credit does this whatnot. But you know, look at the big picture and think if this wasn't here, it would affect the P&L this way and stuff like that. Same with pharmacy.
Yeah. So I think that's just that oversight of like whatever you're doing, looking at things from. I've always had this like ability that I don't know like if other people do this, but like I can look at like I look at MMG from the outside in all the time. It's almost like I have like a bird's eye view of what's happening. And I look at like where the problems lie. And like when we start with the company marketing wise, I find a lot of problems that have nothing to do with marketing.
Yeah.
That like I start looking at a company as a whole and like it's something that as MMG progresses, I'm going to get in like business consulting also.
Yeah.
Because I can look at a company and I see like I've walked in places and I'm like that manager has no fucking business being here whatsoever. Like I can read people quickly. I can say like, hey, that person has it or they don't. That person's power tripping. You're struggling with efficiency of these 8 people because of that person. If you get rid of that person, get a good manager in, you can triple production without even paying for marketing. Like you could probably fix a lot more with paying a little bit more instead of getting marketing. Like that's where I want to get into the space that a lot of times people want to fix all their problems with marketing. And guess what? For us, most people will be like, any marketing company out there is going to be like, yeah, fix your problems with marketing, whatever, pay us, blah, blah, blah. A lot of times marketing is not always the fix.
Well, the thing that comes back to me is the dealership that was like, we're cutting marketing and Dane goes, yeah, I would too. And then the guy's like, you got 5 minutes. You're the marketing guy, right? You're telling me to cut marketing.
Yeah.
You got 5 minutes to talk.
Yeah. The guy goes, he's looking at me and I'm like, I 100%, I wouldn't be paying for us. And the guy, so I sit down as GM, we're sitting in his office and he goes, so why shouldn't I pay you guys? He goes, what's your position here? Like, how are you going to spend this? I go, quite frankly, I'm like, I came from the car business. I go, you have 12 of the weakest sales guys I've ever seen in my life. I go, I wouldn't even give them 10 fucking leads, let alone right now they're getting 1,000. I go, you guys aren't selling shit for cars.
We're just wasting them.
I go, you're wasting them. I go, give them 3,000. I go, they're still not going to sell any fucking cars. I go, it doesn't matter. I go, unless somebody's walking in that door, shaking their head, straight up and down, like spitting out too. I go, unless they're shaking their head straight up and down, just saying yes, like any objection that's coming up, not a salesperson in there could overcome it. So I'm like, you're just wasting money. I go, you're bleeding money at the whole front end of this dealership. I go, fix. And he's like, well, he goes, I've talked to the managers about that, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, and also to be frank with you, I go, you have four tower managers, three of which are not qualified to ever sit at a tower in a dealership.
Yeah.
And he's like, what do you mean? I go, they can't bid cars. They can't desk deals. They can't do anything that they're supposed to do. They're not training the salespeople. They're not helping them out. They have no respect from the salespeople. I go, your whole entire front end of this dealership is broken. I go, until you fix that, you don't need marketing. I go, you need to get your online presence for your photos of your cars better. I go, we're in springtime. Half your cars are photoed in the snow. I go, half your cars don't even have photos.
Yeah.
I go, half your used inventory is not even here, and none of your management even knows where the hell it's at. I'm like, you have $500,000 worth of inventory that's missing. I go, so yeah, you know what? I wouldn't pay for marketing right now. I go, I'd probably sort all that shit out and then give us a call.
So I mentioned earlier how like it's much more profitable for an employer just to pay more and retain their employees rather than to have the churn. It's the same way with a customer. So from a higher level thinking in that situation, I have 1,000 leads coming in and talking to my salespeople per month. They have a very bad experience with them. Guess where they're never going to come back to? Because when they go to buy a car the next time, and the next time after that, they're going to think, oh, yeah, those dudes at that dealership, they're a joke. Like, I went in there this one time. They didn't know what they were talking about. Yeah, I'm not going back there. You didn't just lose one deal. You lost four plus every or whatever it is, plus every person that they would refer to you on top of that. The long-term value of a customer is and the referrals that they'll send you is so important.
I learned a stat when I first got in the car business. I have no earthly idea if it's true or not, but I was told when I first got into the car business, when I was selling cars at 18 to 20 years old, I had a sales manager. He looks at me and I was working with a client and everything. And he goes, go out, do this, blah, blah, blah. I end up becoming friends with the guy. He goes, that guy will be worth $425,000 to the life of him buying cars. I sat there. I'm like, that's a big number, bro. I'm like 20 years old. I don't have like shit to my name. And I'm like that.
Holy.
Whoa. Shit. Like, what do you mean, dude? And then we start going over like how many times somebody gets their oil changed in a year.
Yep.
We start going over. We go over the guy's like 30 years old. We're going over this guy. If he bought all of his cars from us until he was like 70, he goes, I'm not even, that's saying he doesn't live past 70. He goes, he gets all of his cars serviced here. He goes, this is him sending like this many referrals to us a year, which wasn't anything crazy. He goes,
that one too.
He goes, you didn't get that one. He goes,
not that one.
Average like trade cycle is 2 years. He goes, we're going to figure it out 4. So he goes through this whole thing. We break down all the math and we have this paper and it comes out to like, it was almost 500 grand. And I was like, yeah. Holy shit. And he goes, this is why you take care of every single person.
Yep.
So then you look at like a dealership that's getting 1,000 leads in a month. That's burning everyone. And it goes the same way in the pharmacy industry. It goes the same way in marketing. It goes the same way in anything that you do. When you burn that one person and dealerships, I always come back to it because they're such a large entity that thinks so small. Like it really kind of blows my mind on how the car business
They're worried about the deal now today. How many cars did we sell?
Phenomenal managers in the car space and phenomenal leaders in the car space always focus on next year's car deals. And it's like shitty people in the car business focus on this month's car deals. And it's like, it's a weird thing to do, look at. And like, I was even stuck in it when I was inside of it. But once I've gotten outside of it and I've seen it from so many different areas, it's crazy where you see all the broken pieces. And like, you probably can look at pharmacies and say like, hey, this is a problem. This is a problem. This is a problem. Like, and it makes perfect sense to you because you've watched it forever.
Yeah. Well, pharmacy is hard because there's no logic applied. So like if somebody comes in on a Saturday afternoon, we close at 2:00 and they come in at 1:30 with a kid who's obviously got a fever. The mom's crying. So we can't get in a doctor. We've got this script. It's not, it will be filled until Monday morning, whatever. You know, you give them a pill to get through until Monday, or do CBS route dome, you know, well, no, you can't do it. Yeah. Kick rocks, you know. I mean, that's where it's the care versus
the business.
Business, yeah. You know. I mean, you look at everything as, you know, black and white, or the, you know I can give this, you know, one, obviously we're not talking controlled substances, but, you know, you can give this one, you know.
Nice catch.
I think I got that one.
There's gnats flying around this kitchen. So
once again, Logan,
it's on a quality Airbnb.
Yeah. Logan on the that's Airbnb.
Put the fruit away, fruit flies. Yeah. I feel like we probably should say that we aren't financial advisors. We aren't investment people. Everyone's situation's different. So if you're listening to this, don't take our advice perfectly for your situation. We are not liable
for your financial side of it and a personal side of it.
Yeah.
You can make as much on the personal side.
And personal side, like, I think once again, there's a lot of people that are just terrible with money. And I think we could run 50 podcasts on personal finance.
Yeah. It's an interesting space because the education system in America doesn't teach you at all anything about that. It's left up to your home life to teach you that. And like I said, it's hard for parents to teach their kids what they don't know. Yep. So there's resources out there that, and they're very accessible to kids now, but it's a hard thing.
You watch the same family cycle go round and round. Yep. That you have these parents that have lived paycheck to paycheck to paycheck to paycheck, and they've taught their kids that it was like, okay, if you can afford this vehicle and you can afford this and you can afford this, and this is how much you make, this much is in taxes, and then it's like they teach them how to live.
Just how to spend all their money.
They really do.
How to spend your money.
Yeah.
They teach them like you can live right to this point, but just so you know, if you go over that, then like you're going to lose shit. But if you can run it right to this edge,
yeah.
And then actually, you always have people that don't even give a shit about that edge.
Trust me, being in the car business,
don't give a damn about that edge.
Yeah, you definitely have a lot of people that
there
blow right by it. But it's, I don't know. I've always looked at it as, I have nice cars. I have those things, but it's like I live so far within my means.
And it's different when you own a business and run a business too. There's we could get into a whole podcast too about the tax benefits of owning personal of.
You know what I think is probably one of the craziest things though, is colleges, institutions of higher learning. You go through there and you really don't learn anything about how to manage or spend your money. And especially when you know, you have a D1 program, you guys win the national championship all the time. You have all these athletes, you know, are going to be making millions of dollars, and you give them no education on how to manage their
money. I'm pretty sure now they have a 45 minute
fucking spending class. It blows my mind. It really does.
It's insane. The goal of colleges and higher institutions of education or whatever is to keep people in the rat race and to keep people working. I mean, it's truly probably the biggest power trip that there is in America of saying, oh yeah, you have to do this because this makes you smart. This is how you make it in the world.
How much faster has inflation went via colleges over everything in the world? I'm pretty sure inflation in colleges insane. In the last year have surpassed inflation rates by it was hundreds and hundreds of percent.
Yeah. They talk about forgiving student debt. I'm like, well, we can talk about that, but if you're not going to fix the bleeding, it does nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're in the same.
You're just going to keep putting tourniquets on.
I was halfway appalled by that.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm like, no, when I went to college, I knew what I was signing up for.
Yeah.
So I knew exactly. I signed saying I would fucking pay this back, and that's what I intended.
They sent me a deal apply for the forgiveness or whatever.
Yeah.
And I literally didn't fill it out. I was like, I'm perfectly okay with my, I know it's $141 that I have. It's like 30 grand that I have or whatever it is factored over. When I got out of college, I said that I was perfectly fine with, that's what I signed up for. Do I use it? No. Do I need it to be forgiven? Absolutely not. That's something I took on.
Yeah.
No one else.
So I completely disagree with the forgiveness thing too, but there are people out there that just went to college and just did it because they were 17, 18 years old and expected to make a life decision on what they wanted their life to look like. And it was like, yeah, this is what successful people do. This is what people do. They go to college, just take on this debt. You're fine. I think there are people out there who didn't truly know what they're getting themselves into. I'm not saying that it should be forgiven at all. I just think it's a failure in our education system, in our
I think
what we do.
I think universities should have to co-sign for people. Because remember when we were in like, so I'm going to say 2010 area, 2011 was I think when it really started turning.
That was an interesting time.
I think that was like right around the time when it started turning, because at that point, up to then, there was like very high standards to get into
there college. Was, you had to get accepted.
You had to get accepted into colleges. Like you had to have ACT scores to clear into colleges. You had to have these grades. Now it's became a fucking free for all. Like anybody that goes to school, that as long as you can write your fucking name pretty much, here, what school do you want to go to? We'll finance it out for anything.
Yeah.
Like the government approves everyone.
So actually, I'm not even going
to. I know what you're about to say. And I was thinking the exact same fucking thing. Yep.
But no, it's not going to disregard that. We look at us being there.
I think everyone knows what we're talking about, probably too.
But we sit there and look at, like, you just let everyone go to college, and how many people dropped out our freshman year that I guarantee you have never paid a dollar of their student loans, and those are the people we're supposed to pay for.
Yeah.
And some of them didn't. Some of them
never went to class didn't once. Have to pay.
Yeah. Well, you just like higher end ones. You never, ever, there's no bank that would ever give an 18-year-old $75,000 on a car.
Bro.
No, you for ever. A or for a business loan. If you have a fucking an 18-year-old with a solid business plan,
dude,
couldn't get a fucking loan for what their college value is, but then they just sign it over like, hey, whatever.
I leave TDR and I have a job that I'm making, I mean, a mid six figure person at 25 years old. I have an 800 plus credit score. I have a house. I have the cars. I have everything. And like, I have paid my house down. It was over 50% of the way paid down when I left the dealership. I was making multiple payments every month. I'd pay Mass's car way down. I had very controllable payments. And I leave. I had money in the bank. And I was like, hey, I want to get a business line. And they're like, what's your monthly income? I was like, I don't have any. That's why I was getting a business line. Like, I'm going to start a business. Going into college, yeah, I don't have a fucking job, like anything. Oh,
I'm 18 years old.
I'm 18 years old. I don't know what the hell I'm going to do in life. Oh, you want 100 grand? Here you go. And you go to get a business line. They're like, well, what are you putting up as collateral? Yeah. I'm like, well, like I would prefer not to put up my house, but like, can I do something where it's non-collateral? Like, and then when I even talk to them about doing my house, they're like, well, you're not going to be able to get approved because you don't have monthly income. I'm like, how the fuck do I explain this to you guys that I'm opening a business? I just want the capital to run a company. I couldn't get a business line of credit when I first opened. It was like 6 months in, and I had to go to a creative ass banker to sit there and really go over like what I had P&L statement wise for MMG. And I'm like, I'm going out to do something and actually like build a life for myself as an entrepreneur, and not a bank around will do anything to help you. But the government will loan any 18-year-old on the planet any money they want to go to any college they want.
That's the exact difference I was just about to say, is that the difference is it's federal. Government federally subsidized versus private. Like, it's just a flaw.
And even
a
flaw in our system. Community America.
Yeah.
Right. But they are.
They suck.
They're trash now, bro.
They suck. Yeah. Most banks suck.
I've banked with them since high school, and they get me the worst rates probably of anyone.
Yeah.
Dude.
People have
Bank Midwest is the same thing. I went to them to get a personal line for our, like some rehab stuff for our real estate properties for $10,000 to try and do a rehab, like in my name. Mm-hmm. They fucking quoted me at like an astronomical rate. Yeah. And I've banked with them since I was 15 years old.
Their philosophy could be they banked with us for so long, you know, they're going to trust us. They're just going to take the
check. Yeah.
We'll
come in. We'll
sign every time I've tried to get a loan with Community America, someone else that has never even seen me before has bettered it by a good amount.
Yeah.
And the thing is, like, there's a lot of people that I've spoke to over the years that will say, well, this bank sucks and this bank sucks and this bank sucks. And then it's like they come and try to buy a car. I'm like, it's because you're fucking 50 credit. Like, every bank sucks to you. I get it. Yeah. But it's also like my deal is where I struggle with banks is like Dre and I were in the finance sector for a long time in the car business. I understand car deals. I understand what people are looking at. You're looking at people's debt to income. You're looking at all these different factors. And when you go in and at 25 years old, it's like, I never missed a payment on anything. I'd done everything right. I'd taken the 3 credit cards. You never pay them off. You keep them under the 30%. You do everything that you're supposed to do. And then it's like, you get that credit score that's way up there. And I'm like, I'm asking the bank, I'm like, what else could I have done? Like, what else could I have done to position myself at this point to, for this to be a yes? Because it's like, you're at a high 700, low 800 credit score. You have money in the bank. You have everything that you own paid down. And it's like, what was I supposed to, what could I have done?
Well, you know, the funniest thing I think about that is too, because I think we're still talking about Community America.
Yeah.
Is it's a credit union owned by everyone. But the funny thing was
when they were small and they weren't all like corporate, like we talk about being corporate ran. When I first started with them, I could call up my girl at the branch and she would help me out with everything. And it was very quick and easy. Now, I tried to go through the branch to do one of our car deals, and they hit me at a higher rate than the car dealership did through the same fucking bank. And I go, how does this make sense? Well, it's different through the branch. And I'm like, and they needed like five stips to the bank. And I'm like,
that might reaffirm my theory.
So
as you bank with them, they think you just trust them.
Yeah,
dude,
that's bullshit. They fucking stip you. They see your bank account statements.
They see your checks every fucking month.
I look at them like, I could buy this car with a check today, no problem. And I'm like, what? Why did I get hit with different stuff through you guys? And they're like, they're stipping you going through this. I'm like, I worked in the car business for a long time. I know a slam dunk car deal when I see a slam dunk car deal, and it's they're just. I think the banking industry, like if we want to talk about big pharma being a problem, I think big banking is 10 times of a problem.
And they're not even big banking, but yes,
I feel like they're getting there.
I would agree with that,
there's no, like I had seen people come into the dealership and they're like, yeah, I bank at Kearney Trust, blah, blah, blah. I'll say Kearney Trust, if you've ever banked with them, you took care of them. They will do anything for you. They don't give a shit if you pay other people.
Yeah.
But as long as you pay them.
As long as you don't ever burn them.
I will say another one that's good is Clay County Savings Bank. That's who we do all of our real estate deals through, and they work very well with us.
We'd see people come in the dealership, and I'd be like, bro, you're like 500. I'm like, I can't get you done. And they're like, oh, okay, I'll be right back. I'll go get a check. Yeah. I'm like, okay, I'm going to hold my breath. Yeah. And then the funny thing is they're like walk back in and they're like,
your bank and Bethany.
They come walking right back in. They're like, yeah, I went down, saw Keith at the bank, and he gave me a check, and we're good to roll. And I'm like, but it's just they knew people. It's that small town bank deal. Yeah. And it was like, so how did, like, which I get if the big banks did that, they would get screwed so quickly. Yeah.
It's running things like a business versus we talked about earlier.
Like I said, it goes back to that. That's why I have all my money in Houston now, not Bank Midwest. Like Bank Midwest, I wanted a car loan, it wouldn't even call you back. You
know? Well, yeah.
When Houston, you can literally call the person and they're like, when do you need the check? It's not, you know, how do we sign it? How fast you need it?
Can you get it? It's when.
I switched.
Tell them about your dad with the Bank Midwest with the $75,000 check that he couldn't get. They told him it was going to be like 2 weeks.
Yeah. So like we'll take. So we do a couple different types of farming and stuff. And one of them is cash rent, and they'll sign you a check, you know, for
a year's rent.
Yeah, a year's rent, $180 an acre, whatever, for however many acres you got, whatever. And he'll take a $70,000 check in Bank Midwest and throw it on the counter. And they're like, well, this is going to be a 2 week hold, and we got to check this stuff. And it's like, well, if you can't do $70,000, like, I'll take this check somewhere else. They can do $70,000.
If it's a problem, we'll just go elsewhere,
you know.
And in the big picture of like, that's not a ton of money. And
not in the grand scheme of things.
Not even close. No.
And you start dealing with banks. Like I remember what was I doing? I think I was working on like buying Madison's ring, and I was paying for it the way I was doing it or whatever. And I walked in the bank. I was like, hey, I need to get this much cash. And they're like,
you got a little buy here, pay here loan.
I went in. I was like, I want to get cash for it. And I was going separating out my cash and everything, doing it the way I need to do it. And I go in and I ask for cash out, and they're like, they sit there and they're like, yeah, you're going to have to come back in like 3 hours. I go, the fuck? What? I go, what do you mean?
We got to transfer money from the Federal Reserve.
Do it. That's what I was saying. I was like, what do you mean?
And they're like, it's a scary thing that banks can't give that amount of money.
And it wasn't like, it was a good amount of cash, but it wasn't anything like astronomical. And they said, yeah, we have to go get more money from like, I'm like, you guys don't keep shit here. Like,
and they've got to be a safety thing too. I mean, whatever.
But for real, like, I mean, keeping that, like, they're keeping less than 20 grand at a single location.
Yeah.
What it, like, if I have money in a bank and I need 20 grand now for something, like,
I don't care. I don't give a fuck what the amount is. If I have money in your bank and I want it, you better be able to give it to me now.
I've never thought about this, but like, during the Great Depression, that's what people were like, nah, we want our money now.
Yeah.
And I mean, that was a little different. Everybody's bank was crashing and stuff. Right. This is just like, but I need to do this business deal.
Right.
But think about stuff. What if that happened now?
If everyone went to the banks to call their notes now.
That's why banks are going under.
Yeah.
The banking industry is.
The banking industry is flawed. I feel like bankers are crooked. I feel like just the banking space is a whole. Like, there are a lot of people, like, I like the small town bank industry. I don't like the corporate space at all. Like, I think it is so fucking flawed.
I don't know if we'll ever get a banker on this podcast now.
Oh, okay. I actually have a banker buddy that I guarantee would come on here.
I bet I could get one.
I have a banker guy that I would actually like to come on and actually discuss
Big bankers. Let's say that.
No. I actually have somebody that would come on.
No, fuck no.
And he could actually probably bring a lot of insight to the space because – I think we're speaking on a bunch of shit that we probably
really don't know. We're very uneducated about the space. There's a lot more that goes into it.
We're just blowing off steam.
Yeah.
We're just going through
our personal experiences that, you know, frustrating. It's what it is.
But it's also like it started off with the college deal that people can get as much money as they want for college. But then,
not a business.
But not a business. Like, I feel like that's a problem in today's world. And you go apply for one of those federal business loans. Yeah, they just tell you kick rocks. Like,
and then something like COVID happens, and they do all these what were those loans called?
The PPP loans.
PPP loans that they just fucking forgive people for. Like, they get businesses like
I know one
$500,000 loans.
I know a company that got just 500 G's that they just forgave
because of COVID. You don't have to pay it.
Fucking personal money they just sent out to people too.
It's fucked. We could talk all night about this, but
that'll go on for days. But
how should we wrap it up? We got a last question.
I would ask Ben what he would go back and tell his 20 year old self. That was not that long
ago. I mean, he is 26 now.
He's
closer to 30 than.
All right, Ben, if you would go back 6 years, tell yourself something that you know now. Drop some knowledge on your 20-year-old self. What would you go say,
buddy?
I don't know. I mean, the public accounting was good experience, but I think you probably could have done more straight out of college, joining something. I mean, it was MMG or whatever, but like something startup that you have faith in, I think is where the.
So you're saying bet on yourself.
Bet on yourself. Yeah. That could be the better.
Which I will say on the startup space, when people jump in on that, you have to have faith in the startup, but you're also betting on yourself. It's a two-way street.
It is. Have a good idea.
I have someone I know that has done very successful in the finance space in that, doing that, just a startup. And so,
And
then finding something you like is pretty important.
Very cool.
If you don't like it, find something you're not going to like it. You could make $200,000 a year if you don't like it.
Well, just so you know, I'm never coming to compete with you in the accounting space.
Okay.
I don't like it. So that's why Dre has that job.
The sleeping Dre over there is our CFO for a reason.
Looks like
he's awake right now. He just flipped me off.
Dre, what's the debit? What's the credit?
I don't even think he volunteered for it. I think I just made him do it.
Hey, you're the fucking CFO, bro. I'm tired of this shit.
Dre's the only one still dusty as hell from golf today.
Yeah.
He's the only one that hasn't showered.
What a fucking grind ball.
You better go take a shower, bud. We're about to leave here.
Yeah. All right. Any final thoughts?
Club or casino?
Club or casino?
Nah, let's not get into this. That's the final thought for the night.
Club or casino. Yeah. So that is a decision we'll be making after the M3 podcast. But thank you, everyone, for joining. Yep. Ben, thank you for coming on. Yep. This was a blast. Once again, we're not financial advisors. We might try to get a financial advisor on here that they do that for a job. We might try to get a banker on to where they can defend themselves and actually give us some actual. Yeah.
We just come at all their heads without giving them a chance.
Real insights. So that is going to be it. Peace out.
Thanks for listening to the M3 Podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss the next episode. Want to learn more? Check us out on Instagram at Moss Marketing Group, on Facebook at Moss Marketing 58, or on our website at mossmarketinggroup.com.